This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today's guests are Lee Mars and Justin Zorn. Lee is a leadership and collaboration consultant with organizations including Harvard, Google, and IKEA. She has led a multi-year program teaching experimental mindsets to multi-generational teams at NASA. Lee is also a longtime student of pioneering researchers and practitioners of the ritualized use of psychedelic medicines in the West. Lee lives in Berkeley, California, with her husband and daughter. Justin has served as both a meditation teacher and a senior policymaker in the U.S. Congress. He is a Harvard and Oxford-trained specialist in the economics and psychology of well-being, and who has written for The Atlantic, Washington Post, The Guardian, The Harvard Business Review, Foreign Policy, Wired, Time, CNN, and others. And he lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with his wife and three children. Justin and Lee recently released Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise, published with HarperCollins in the U.S. Penguin and the U.K., and is coming out in 14 languages globally. Together, they founded Estrella Strategies, a consultancy that bridges deep vision with impactful communications and action. This was just a great conversation today with Lee and Justin, and it's this is cool stuff. I mean, silence is something that we can all agree we need more of in our life, but it's hard to come by. And what does silence really mean, and how can it impact our lives? We have so much data, information, just coming at us all the time, and with our screens and just information coming from everywhere. It's just amazing that we don't feel overwhelmed like most of us do. So I think it's a great conversation to consider. The stuff's pretty deep. It's real fascinating, in my opinion, and I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. So let's jump right in and talk to Lee and Justin. Lee and Justin, welcome to the program. I'm really excited to have you on today.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
So just tell me a little bit about how you two came together and decided to write your book, which is titled Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise. How did you get together, and how did you decide to work on this? And I would like to start with that.
Some years ago, it was about 7 years ago now, I left Washington, D.C. My wife and I moved out to a beautiful place in the mountains near Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I was figuring out the next phase of my career, going from being a policymaker in Washington to doing consulting, communications consulting, public policy, and leadership advising work. And I was introduced to a friend, to Lee, and we became friends. She gave me some really valuable advice. We had the opportunity to do a little bit of writing together. And we realized around this time, around 2016, 2017, that we were just feeling despondent about the state of the world. We were just feeling like, what is it going to take for us to solve the divisions in our society, to reclaim some creativity, to get past the feeling of overwhelm that it felt like everyone we knew was feeling? And we realized we both had the same intuition about where to look for the answer. And that was by getting beyond the noise and looking, listening in silence. So we thought this idea of listening into silence as a source of solutions to the problems facing leaders and facing humanity, we thought it might seem a little new agey. So we decided to try to write an article about it for the least new agey publication we could think of, Harvard Business Review.
Yeah, there you go.
And Lee, you want to say a little bit more about where we took it from there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were exploring this idea of finding more silence and as a matter or means for identifying maybe strategies that hadn't been tapped before to really tap into our collective wisdom. And so with that hunch, we wrote this article, as Justin said. And to our surprise, that article went viral. So we thought, okay, this is signaling something important. This is resonating to that particular audience, which we were hoping to reach, but we had no idea if this was going to meet their need. So we took a few steps back and decided to start having interviews with people. We just chose this incredible range of people: neuroscientists, politicians, artists, poets, a man incarcerated on death row, a whirling dervish, all sorts of people, acoustic ecologists, you know, and asked them this question: what's the deepest silence you've ever known? And their answers really shaped this book for us, taking us certainly to places of auditory quiet, like, you know, deep remote cabins and things like that, but also to an internal silence, places like that were maybe auditorily loud, but quiet inside, moments of awe and births and deaths, and even times where the outside world could be incredibly raucous, like when you're running the perfect line through roaring rapids or at an all-night dance party. So we broke out noise to look at auditory, informational, and internal noise, which we'll go into more deeply, and then exploring silence externally, of course, but also internally.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think, in your book, you talk about silence as more than the absence of noise. It's a presence as well. So explain that to us, and what does that mean, presence?
Sure. So we think of silence really in terms first of noise, is the absence of noise. And by noise, we mean that which is interfering with our clear perception and intention. So we think of noise not just as sound or data or thought, but we think of noise as unwanted distraction. And there are these different levels to it, you know, the auditory level, the informational level, the internal level. There's the noise that affects us in our ears and also on our screens and in our heads. But we think of silence, as you just mentioned, as something more than just the absence of noise. I mean, at one level, it's that. At one level, it's this space where no one is making claims in our consciousness, where no one is interfering. But in all these conversations with this extraordinarily diverse group of people that we interviewed for this book, we found this common denominator to people's experience, that there's a certain deep level of silence that's also a presence unto itself. It's this space of pristine attention.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anything to add there, Lee?
Yeah, just that, well, we got very specific about the type of noises that we spoke about. We actually did want to keep it quite spacious in terms of our definition for such a silence as that, as a presence unto itself. But we do turn to a few people for some definitions, and that might help infuse our conversation with some of the ways we're looking at silence in that more vast silence as presence way. So Gordon Hempton, for example, one of our interviewees, an acoustic ecologist, defines silence as the presence of everything, the think tank for the soul.
Hmm. Yeah. That's you have to sit on that one a little bit and think about
yeah,
it.
Right? These are all a bit like that. And Pir Shabda Khan, a Sufi teacher, describes silence as not silent at all, that it's teeming with life and joy and ecstasy, but it's quiet of thoughts of the self. It's quiet of foolishness.
Yeah, you know, it's in thinking about this, silence, I think most of us can look at it and say, oh, of course, that's a good thing if we can find it. But one of your quotes in the book kind of grabbed me, because as business leaders, you know, a lot of this is, oh, we need to improve this and we need to get better at that. And so there's a lot of self-improvement going on. So I love the quote in your book where you said silence is bigger than self-improvement. It can't be enlisted as a life hack to advance our personal ambitions. Silence, by definition, has no agenda. So especially from a more analytical side of our, if we're left brain thinking, that quote kind of blows our mind. So what do you mean that silence, by definition, has no agenda?
In the book, we interview a man named Cyrus Habib, who was the son of Iranian immigrants to the U.S. And he went blind at age 8. And he ended up going to Columbia, Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, Yale Law School. And in your area there, he became a state legislator and then eventually lieutenant governor of Washington State when he was in his 30s.
Right. And then we're familiar with him. So, yes, he's elected official up in our state. So, yes.
That's right. That's right. So he makes this wild decision that everyone thinks he's going to, you know, become the next governor and succeed Jay Inslee sometime. He makes this wild decision to go off and take a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience as a novice Jesuit priest. And we explore within this transition he made and the question of why he made this kind of radical decision. And he talks about the need not just to get beyond the noise that you would imagine you'd experience as a politician every day, but the ability to be able to tune in to what's really true. And this was a radical departure for him, because as a politician, like leaders in many other sectors, his job often wasn't to determine what was actually true. It was to prove he was right. It was to find support for his position and you know, cater to the electorate or, you know, win a fundraising battle or whatever it might be. And he realized that in this time in deep silence and his training to become a Jesuit priest, it was like he was retuning his mind. You know, so when we talk about how, like, silence is bigger than any of our kind of life objectives. Silence is more mysterious. It's deeper. This is a big part of what we're talking about. You know, when we spend time really tuning into silence, we're spending time tuning into our real intention. We're tuning into our real effort to grasp what's true in the world.
Mm-hmm. And since we're talking a little bit about political office, Justin, why don't you just share with us your experience on Capitol Hill and how silence could even be used in the same sentence as the U.S. Congress? So what did you see there? What was your experience?
Sure. You know, we talk in the book about about how back in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, the delegates had a giant mound of dirt built outside the convention hall, now Constitution Hall, so that they could do deep work together, so they could have silence, so they could have pristine attention to be able to accomplish what they want to accomplish. And we juxtapose that against what it was like when I worked on Capitol Hill as a legislative director for a few members of Congress about 235 years later, and it was just the noisiest place you could possibly imagine. You know, TVs blasting, ringing alarm bells, signaling floor votes, you know, lobbyists schmoozing and backslapping, and these big boisterous open bar receptions happening every late afternoon, evening. And then you had the informational noise of just nonstop, you know, being glued to your phone, glued to your email. Nonstop interference with your intention, really difficult to do deep thinking or writing. So, you know, we look at this to see that there can be a culture that honors silence, that honors quiet time, or there could be a culture of noise. So I got a chance and the good fortune to get to participate in a little experiment on Capitol Hill where I worked with Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio and some others to create a mindfulness program for both members of Congress and staff. And I write in the book about what it was like to have that experience of meditating with a bunch of really high-strung people in suits in the middle of the U.S. Capitol complex on a busy Monday. I had a chance to lead some of those meditations. And, you know, in the book, we explore how it wasn't just a particular mindfulness practice that made those experiences really moving, really powerful. It was just the experience of sitting in silence with a group like that, sitting with nothing to do. And you could feel after about 20 minutes together in the silence, those amygdalae started to unravel. You started to feel that kind of constant go, go, go pressure that wasn't really conducive to good decision-making. You felt that start to ease, start to relax. And there was a space of a little bit more presence and clarity.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, and somewhat related to that, Lee, maybe you can help us understand, again, from the book, you know, a wealth of information, too much information, kind of creates a poverty of attention. So, you know, we are in an information age. I mean, it's just coming at us in all ways and shapes. And so, you know, it's good we have the information, but yet it can be detrimental too. So explain a little bit of that dynamic.
Yeah. When we first wrote the article for Harvard Business Review, we mentioned we were looking at auditory noise, you know, externally, but we realized in today's age, we absolutely have to consider informational noise, the mass proliferation of mental stuff available to us, much of which is increasingly grabbing for our attention. It's not just that it's out there, it's actually trying to get our attention. And our attentional capacities, you know, while this information is on the rise, our ability to process information hasn't changed in hundreds of thousands of years. We're in a logjam here. And yet still, according to some studies here in the United States, we take in about 5 times more information as we did just a generation ago. So that feeling of like overwhelm of, oh my, you know, I just, there's not only so much more I can take is real. In 2010, Eric Schmidt, then CEO of Google, made a striking estimate that every 2 days we create as much information as we did from the dawn of civilization to 2003.
Oh my
every
gosh.
2 days, yeah, we create, it's like bears repeating, you know,
yeah.
Every 2 days we create as much information as we did from the dawn of civilization to 2003. So there is more stuff available to us. Much of it is grabbing for our attention. Our attentional networks can't take in any more information. The psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi looks at attentional capacities and estimates that we can take in about 120 some bits of information. That's how we talk about information in bits every second. And we are getting 11 million bits flooded to us at any given moment through our senses. So there's an attention problem. It's very real. And that we establish in the book, going through auditory, going through informational, really creates a state of internal stress and chatter and rumination and worry. So we also look at Ethan Cross's research. He's from the University of Michigan. He estimates that we listened to something like 320 State of the Union addresses of compressed speech every day internally. So we are, this compressed speech comes at us at about 4,000 words per minute, about 10 times the speed of expressed speech. So this is the environment, auditory, informational, and internal, in which we're trying to navigate and lead and make good choices and be good members of society and families and friends. And it's too much. So we turn to silence.
You know, it's being a healthcare professional myself, that the story of Rupa Marya, I think her name is, really resonated with me when she stated that, you know, most of what she was taught in medical school runs counter to healing. I got a chuckle out of that because I think that's true. And it reminded me of a story that I had a patient once who was in a very, very serious car accident in rural Poland. And this was 30 some years ago. And so she was injured so badly that she went to the local hospital, but the local hospital had no running water. They had no equipment, and basically they had to have her stabilized there before they could move her on. And so eventually she got well enough to where they moved her on to a, you know, state-of-the-art facility in Germany. But she said while she was in Poland that a lot of her care was a nurse sitting beside her and stroking her hair and saying nothing for hours and hours at a time. And then she went to this very high-level, you know, trauma unit in Germany with all the bells and whistles and whatever. And she said, it occurred to me that I'm not sure where the better care was. She questioned it just because that was so soothing. And, you know, the woman wasn't saying anything. They couldn't communicate. But yet she felt like she was cared for. I think it's a pretty powerful story.
Oh, that's the perfect story to demonstrate what we're talking about in terms of the healing power of silence as well, and that attention and that compassionate presence. And that's exactly what Rupa shares. Justin, could you tell us about Florence Nightingale? I was just thinking about bringing her in. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Florence Nightingale, you know, 150 years or so before the latest research showing the effect of auditory noise on the nervous system and how auditory noise drives the fight or flight response. Florence Nightingale intuited this. And she served as a head nurse in a Scutari hospital, one of the main hospitals attending to the wounded during the Crimean War in the 19th century. And when she was there, even though the conditions were just horrendous, I mean, gangrenous wounds going unattended, unbelievable filth, she considered the noise to be one of the top tier concerns. And that was because she explained that noise essentially drove the fight or flight response and impeded the body's ability to heal. She talked about noise as one of the most cruel absences of care that could be inflicted on a person sick or well. So she got this intuitively. You know, what you're saying about, you know, just that simple presence, that simple attention, that simple peace and quiet as a real pathway to healing. It's real, and medical research today is demonstrating this.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely, you know, from what I've read and the research that I've looked at, it says also that, you know, we're just engaging our sympathetic nervous systems way more than it was ever designed for. And so when it's always turned on and the parasympathetic nervous system is not, that leads to other issues, you know. You know, I know we can't put our exact, you know, thumb on it, but whether it's mental health issues or disease issues or whatever, you do have to wonder if the sympathetic nervous system is just overloaded and working too hard and causing all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, the neuroscientist Judson Brewer was also concerned similarly to just the constant drive for the dopamine hit and what that does. Evolutionarily, that was needed to kind of get us to get up and going and breed and look for food and things like that, but having it access tapped and, you know, exploited essentially day in, day out, what does that do to our system as well? He was deeply concerned about that. Yeah. And the truth is we're just coming to understand that. We have a chapter in the book, a silent or mute button for the mind, basically, as we're looking for a mute button for the mind. And there's something to this. This is back to Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow states, that when we are in this state of flow, when our attention is captivated by what we're doing and we're like using all of our attentional capacities there, then there's no space for this self-referential thought, the self-consciousness, us telling stories about ourselves about it in that moment. And that turns out to be a really blissful experience for us, a pretty universal blissful experience. And there's infinite routes to that experience. So we look at, what is it like to find that internal deep quiet in the mind, in this state of a constant stimulus going on around us? And we can find that not just through meditation, as many people, you know, turn towards and we have in the past, but also through simple flow states and micro flow states like doodling or deep reading or moments of awe and experiences, mystical experiences, all kinds of self-transcendent experiences. And it turns out transcending ourselves is a quiet and happy experience.
Well, this might be a good time for you to expand and tell your story that intrigued me about your smoking story. So, you know, what the smoke break actually did, and people don't have that anymore because we've become a society that smokes so much less. So explain that to us, your own personal story and what you discovered about that.
Right. Somewhat self-consciously, as I'm talking to people, or a lot of people are in health work, but I make a confession that I was a past smoker, but the confession is more than that. It's that I really loved it. Like I relished the quiet I got in those smoke breaks throughout my day, working in high pressure crisis work with runaway teens and battered women a little later in my work career. And I love the ritual of it, the sizzle of that first drag and watching the smoke rise through the sunbeams and the moonshot and moonlight and things like that. And the deep inhale and the exhale that I would get in those moments and just the interruption of that stress and that flow. But I'm glad, of course, I quit smoking, and I'm glad that most of us seems to have. But I think we also quit those breaks. We quit that time to reflect upon things or maybe prepare for what was to come. And instead, it's just work, 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 go, 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 nonstop, back-to-back meetings, packed with content, no downtime, you know, switch to the next. And so we have a chapter in the book called Healthy Successor to the Smoke Break, where we give some ideas for how we, you know, other things we can do that are not a lot of doing. It's actually some not doing in there, but to find those moments of quiet throughout the day, because that is one route in, is those micro moments of quiet.
Yeah. And in the optimal breathing world, we've learned that just by breathing in through your nose as opposed to your mouth, that stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system and actually changes that fix that we just talked about earlier. And so I would imagine that, you know, smoking in a weird way kind of simulates that as well, you know, that you're just breathing in a different way, and it gives you that time of pause and that time of reflection. So yeah, I think that's real interesting. You know, Justin, maybe you can share with us a little bit, how can people weave silence into these fully engaged lives that we're leaving? They're living, I'm sorry, living.
This is a question that I'm still figuring out the answer to for sure, even after having written this book. I've got 2-year-old twins at home and a 6-year-old and a full work schedule, and it is a challenge. I mean, even if we have a serious meditation practice or a lot of strategies in place, it's always something that we have to navigate for ourselves. But in the book, we explore quite a few different approaches, and all of them, the kind of common denominator to them, is to notice noise and to appreciate silence, is to really take stock of where there is interference with our clear perception and intention in our lives. And to find the moments of silence in our lives, even if they're very small, and be able to see them not just as kind of an irritation or a kind of downtime or a kind of FOMO experience of, oh, why aren't I doing something else? But when we have that little moment, that little interruption, a little period of silence, to be able to go into it, to be able to savor it, to appreciate it. And what we explore in the book is that that might simply be stepping outside and listening to the sound of the breeze, listening to the rustling of the leaves and the branches, going into a quiet room and listening to nothing in particular. Researchers at Duke Medical School found some years back that the act of listening in silence is found to demonstrably improve growth in neurons associated with memory in the brain. So if we could just take a few minutes, maybe even take a minute or less, and you don't need a fancy meditation practice, but simply be able to step outside or step into a quiet place and just simply listen, it can go a long way toward restoring our energy, restoring our memory in some cases, restoring our presence.
Well, I do appreciate in the book that a lot of the things you suggest are those little things. You know, it's always daunting to, you know, to read something and say, oh, that makes a lot of sense, but, you know, I don't have 2 hours to meditate a day, or, you know, I can't see how I could get that into my life. But yet there's a lot of suggestions for the little things, just like you described, that do make a difference. And throughout the day, they compound and can put us in a different mindset for sure.
Mm-hmm. We call this a non-meditator's guide to getting beyond the noise, as we did not write this book, as Justin described his life with 3 kids are pretty young, and I have a teenager and also full life. We did not write this book because for people who are running off to 6 months of meditation retreat, or even where meditation is perhaps not their way at all, we're writing it for people who need something else, right, to fit in. So a non-meditator's guide. So we look at all kinds of routes, including these micro moments in our day, like that breath you described. And we asked a professor of biobehavioral health and medicine about this, like, what is quiet, thinking maybe we needed to focus more on that meditative state. And he said, well, this is Dr. Joshua Smythe at Penn State. He said, quiet is what people think quiet is. And quiet is what people experience quiet to be. So we suspect that there are many, let's say, infinite routes to finding quiet, and they may even surprise you. And he spoke of a man in one of his studies who finds his quiet while chainsaw carving large chunks of wood in a flow state. So there can be any number of ways in. Our assertion here is that this is something innate to being human. This is not another to-do or another complex thing, or you know, even a like fancy life hack or anything like that. We as humans know about quiet. We know our ways to quiet. We know how important it is. So here we just hope to remind people to take that time in small ways and in large, together and alone.
You know, I think it brings up the point, too, that too much of anything cannot be good. I was fascinated about the story of Jarvis J. Masters in San Quentin, and so maybe you can share with us what you learned from him. And tragically, solitary confinement was called the Adjustment Center, which I thought was pretty bizarre. But just, you know, here's a guy who, you know, has had way too much time in solitary confinement, but then he also found a way to do it in a noisy situation as well. So just explain what you learned from his experience.
Sure, you want to lead us off, Lee?
What? Yeah, either way.
Justin, go ahead.
Okay. So Jarvis is someone who speaks of silence as a matter of survival. He's been on death row for more than 30 years for a crime that the evidence shows that he didn't commit. And he's now this renowned meditation teacher, and he's studied with famous Tibetan lamas and published books and been on the New York Times bestseller list. But he is still in prison. He's still on death row. And in our conversations with him, we've become close with him. And he emphasizes how the auditory landscape of prison, the noise of prison is just extreme. I mean, you have these party beats playing on lo-fi radios and sports games playing and nonstop hollering and yelling. And there's this noise of just the constant fear, the uncertainty, the violence, the state-sanctioned death on death row. And Jarvis has become adept at finding silence, even in this landscape, even in this space. You know, he finds these little micro moments where, even though he has so little control in his life, he can find what's in his own sphere of control. So maybe it's just that he finds his quiet while doing jumping jacks in his cell or studying astronomy or Buddhist texts. And he mostly, though, describes to us how he navigates the noise by finding quiet within himself. You know, he talks about how he discovered the noisiest part of being in prison for him was his own mind. So he says, I started quietening the noise by quietening my responses to the noise.
When we turn to Jarvis, he becomes a primary teacher, really the primary teacher in our book, because of, as Justin described, you know, he has so little control out of his day, 23 hours out of a 24-hour day, he's in his cell. But he still has a sphere of control, he would argue, the ability to navigate the noise as he does. So he teaches us about that sphere of control, the things you have power over. And for him, it's increasingly his mind, due to all of his studies and his concentration, working with the system around him. And one of the things, he's written two books while on death row, two. He does that while the other men incarcerated there are maybe watching games, and there's no one needing his attention. There's no one calling out his name. You know, they're all focused on the game and having a good time, and he can focus on his writing. So he looks at his sphere of control, sphere of influence, that which he, you know, he also has other people who advocate around him. They say, hey, man, Jarvis is writing, leave him alone, things like that. So, you know, and we have spheres of influence as well. And then there's that which is outside of our control. And for Jarvis, there's a whole lot there. And that he just lets go. So as a teacher, he comes in to kind of remind us that we do have a sphere of control, no matter how noisy things feel and seem, and how powerless we may feel in the midst of that, and that we can find that space, those little micro moments we talked about. We can find that those kinds of practices together as well, because we find that silence is magnified when it's shared. So whether we're talking about coworkers or friends or family members, there's a way to share silence that can really deepen the sense of relationship and communication and intimacy in those moments, and as well as the ability to really get into some deep exploration strategies, you know, finding answers to complex and seemingly intractable problems, as Justin and I are trying to do with our various coalitions and work in the world.
And the opposite of that is when he was in solitary confinement for decades. So what did you learn from that? I'm not suggesting it's a good thing to do. It's just that I'd be interested to know what he gives, gives his, craft at this point. Does he say that was helped develop that in the extreme of the solitary confinement?
He describes that as that it was a little bit what Justin was pointing to as a matter of survival. He was in the adjustment center, in solitary confinement for 22 years, longer than any human has ever been in solitary confinement in San Quentin. So the vast majority of the sentence that he's been and still is in, his case is on appeal, was in the adjustment center. And when he came out and just was entered the East Block, where he lives now, the sound, the auditory sound, was so... that basically there's solid wall that separated him and his solitary confinement was gone, and everything was then mesh wire. So sound became that much louder. It was so intense for him, so overwhelming to his nervous system and to his self, that he had an extreme epileptic seizure. So it took some adjusting to get to that louder environment. While he was on solitary, he was doing a lot of self-soothing and mind control, trying to focus on finding that quiet, that quietening his response to the noises, as Justin was saying. Then he actually had to contend with a louder environment when he got into the East Block, and now he's accustomed to that too. So it's been a constant adjustment there, constant adjustment. He's the master.
And Justin, do you feel that the epidemic rise in anxiety and mental health issues that we're experiencing in today's world, do you think that, is it related to the increased noise and information in our lives? Is that what you feel?
If you look at just the absolute rise in the amount of mental stimulation, as we were talking about before, something like at least five times as much information the average American deals with today as in 1986 compared to 1986, you know, it stands to reason that there's going to be a lot more activation of the fight or flight response. There's going to be a lot less spaciousness within human consciousness. And when there's that lack of spaciousness, I think anxiety arises. These kinds of troubles arise. We spoke with Judson Brewer, the really celebrated scholar of neuroscience and psychology, who has been looking at the minds of seasoned meditators for quite a while. And he's studied in all these experiences. He's found that there's a kind of common denominator to what people describe as the experience of noise in the consciousness versus silence in the consciousness. And noise in the consciousness, he tells us, based on these studies and, with fMRIs and also interviews with the people he's working with and the studies who he's studying, the kind of common denominator to the experience of noise in the consciousness is a feeling of contraction. And the kind of common denominator to what people experience as silence, as quiet in the consciousness, is a feeling of expansion. So we look at this kind of framework he offers us, contraction and expansion, to think about mental health, because a lot of mental health challenge people face is a kind of contracted feeling. But, you know, one of the ironies, Stephen, that we've encountered in this is that feeling of contraction is often a kind of feeling that people are going for in this day and age. Like, we often associate happiness or success with a dopamine rush. It's something Dr. Brewer emphasized to us.
And that dopamine rush is a contracted state. It could be a kind of noisy state. It could be even the activation of that fight or flight response. And that kind of expansive, kind of harmonious, kind of quiet is a different vision of happiness. It's a different vision of progress in our lives.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You also talk in the book about paying attention to signals, and then you make a shift. So identifying the noise will automatically decrease it if you can define it and make an adjustment. So tell us how that works in daily practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really didn't want to write a book that was super prescriptive, like noise is always this, because it turns out it's incredibly subjective and one person's noise is another person's symphony, or that quiet is this and looks this way. So we turn the reader, and in this case, your listeners, back to yourself, yourselves as the authority on this. What brings noise in? When do you notice you're soaked with noise, you're saturated with noise, and you're feeling the effects of that? Well, for myself, I notice an irritability arising in me, an emotional state of irritability, which is not my norm at all. So if I'm looking around and feeling incredibly irritable, especially with my loved ones here, I know something's up. Like, I know I need some space and some quiet, or to find some respite somewhere. I notice that also in my body signals. So a tightness in my diaphragm in particular is the telltale there. If it goes untreated, if I'm not paying attention to it further, then it can even wake me up in the middle of the night with a bit of a panic attack. There's jaw clenching, you know, all kinds of signals that I am noise soaked and in need of quiet. But on the other side of that is really when I'm finding the quiet I need. What is that like? And I notice all those things I just described are pretty contracted, like Justin was describing. And then there's the expansion of quiet for me. Well, I feel much more fluid in my joints. I'm just feeling more, I'm not so preoccupied with my own thinking. I'm more expansive, more connected to nature, those kinds of things. That tells me I'm getting enough quiet and enough silence. So really it's a matter of really taking note and maybe experimenting as well in there to take notice of what really brings you joy, what really brings you quiet, what really feels like noise in you, even if it's different than those around us, and adjusting accordingly.
Yeah, I talked to a gentleman one time who basically said that he called it triggered, but if you're triggered, like you're upset or angry or, you know, on the edge or whatever, if you can identify what it is that's triggered you, and give it a voice or give it a thing, like let's say that person disrespected me. If I know what that is, then 50% of that anxiety and emotion can go away just by identifying what it is, and then it helps you be able to move on from it.
Absolutely. If we can avoid pushing it off to the margins where it tends to have a lot more power and control over us, and instead kind of acknowledge it, like you say, bring it to the foreground and name it, even that will change the circumstances. So I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I love that.
It's interesting, just a lot of thoughts come to mind when reading this book. And one of them was, I'm a guitar player. And I can remember that at one point when I was working with a mentor, and we were doing lead guitar, and we were working on, you know, playing the notes. And one thing he said to me really stuck with me is he said, you know, the good guitar players are the ones who know when not to play the note. And I thought, wow.
Exactly. Because, you know, this is an important theme in the book too, Stephen, this idea of when not to play the note. And it's something, Lee and I joke, we're both big talkers. So it's kind of a ironic thing and a journey for us in writing this book, you know, because sometimes we've been known to talk too much. But it's like there's this Japanese concept of ma. It's an ancient aesthetic principle that means the empty space between the notes in music, or the empty space between brush strokes on a painting. And the word ma, the kanji character in Japanese, means golden sunlight pouring through the slats of a temple gate.
And Ma is found all throughout traditional Japanese philosophy and arts, even the space between seeds when you're planting a garden or planting crops. So we look at this idea of Ma. What would it mean to bring more Ma into our world, our organizations, you know, brainstorming processes on teams, all of this? You know, we look what it would mean to put Ma, bring Ma into the job, or even have Ma go back to bring Ma to Washington.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, and describe a little bit more too, what you mean by, you used the word earlier in the interview, flow. So describe what flow is and how that is linked to silence.
Yeah, we made that link as we got into the work of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi on flow states. So there's many different components that make up flow, but the one we really zoomed in on that we were most interested in is when the what he describes as the attentional capacities being maxed, the focus is on what you're doing. There's a certain level of mastery the person has with that, and yet all their attentional capacities are needed. And therefore, that self-referential thought, there's no space for that. You can't be too worried about how you're looking in this moment or seeming and that kind of stuff. If you click into that kind of thinking, then that's when you mess up. We actually zoom in on a middle schooler, you know, who is arguably, when we're in middle school, at the peak of our self-consciousness. And here here he is playing on the ball court. And when he's in that hot on the court, as he describes it, or in that flow state, he's not worried about what everyone's thinking, but he's very aware when he does start thinking like, oh, I missed that shot. What is everybody thinking? Then he's back into the prefrontal cortex and he's not in a state of flow. So those people, and probably many of your listeners have like ongoing experience with a flow state. For example, I dance and I know when, as soon as I think something, I'm in the midst of a class and I'm doing choreography that might be new and the class is following me right in real time. And we can all feel like this terrific organism moving around in space, and then suddenly I'll think something like, do I have an 11 o'clock meeting? And then poo, it's gone. It's like that moment is gone. And so it becomes a great area of experimentation. So we turn to flow because it is such a universal experience, one we know so well, of an internal quiet where our egoic self is smaller, and yet we're expanded in a whole other way. Like Judson Brewer describes, we feel connected to, you know, all, maybe I feel like connected to everyone in that dance class, or we feel connected to nature, we feel connected to our team on the ball court. So we're both smaller and larger. And that this is a really blissful experience for us. And we call it quiet. We make that case and kind of bridge to those self-transcendent experiences, of which there's so many of those. And that's a big area of interest in neuroscience now. And actually in cross-disciplinary sciences, they're looking at these mental states and how they may be quite similar in that way. Those moments of awe, flow states, mystical experiences, and even experiences brought about through mind expanding entheogenic plants and medicines. So there's all kinds of routes into this internal quiet I describe.
Yeah, I love that. Just let it flow. Sometimes we overthink it.
Totally.
You know, if you're in the zone, stay in the zone. Don't ask, why am I in the zone, right? Just,
exactly, because then you're not in the zone anymore. Exactly. But maybe you can get right back in. Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, as we start to wind down here a little bit, is there anything in the anticipation of our interview or our discussion today that I haven't asked you that you think is important to get into our program?
You know, one thing that comes up for me is just that, you know, silence sometimes gets equated with apathy or withdrawal. You know, the silence of like, of wanting to be complicit or complacent in something that's wrong. Like when you see something wrong going on and you remain silent. And we work in the book and this whole process, this exploration, to discern the kind of silence that we seek, not the silence of oppression and withdrawal. And what we look at in the book is that true silence of the kind that we're talking about, which is clear perception and intention, is kind of the polar opposite of this sort of censorship or this sort of withdrawal that we're talking about. Because we find that a noisy world creates injustice. A noisy world creates a lot more division and kind of lack of courage and energy to address what's wrong. You know, if we're all caught up in checking our Instagram likes and watching reality TV or, you know, trying to fill the space in conversation, then it's hard to really hear another person. It's hard to really perceive what needs to be done in a good way. So a big part of our writing this book is to reframe the meaning of silence away from apathy and withdrawal towards something positive, clear thinking, pristine attention.
Yeah. As we looked at that, took that journey that Justin was just taking us on, realized that this was really getting down to discernment, the ability to discern the true signal, that which we need to pay attention to, from the noise, which, as we've already established, is out there. How do we pierce through that? Well, our discernment is one of those ways. And in the workplace, that can be about really learning to do that together. If we have a really important meeting coming up, or even a retreat where we're taking on like bigger strategy questions, to actually build in time for that quiet reflection, to build in time in nature, if we can, by chance, to build in time for people to relate in different ways, naturally, more organically, then we're inviting in space for that tuning in to the real signal, discerning what is true, what is needed in this moment. Maybe what is the breakthrough idea for this, you know, seemingly intractable problem. So we really like to encourage that in small and large ways, like that we maybe don't schedule meetings back to back or assume a meeting should be 1 hour and then flip to the next meeting without any time for preparation or any time for integration, or any time for reflection. That our meetings aren't packed by just people who are, you know, defaulting to the tyranny of the fastest and loudest, so that it's just the people who speak up fast and first that contribute, that maybe we make time for quiet reflection or even generate ideas on post-it notes or paper, come silently and give us time to peruse and digest. That really invites in diversity of thought and inclusion of people who may be a little bit more physical kinesthetic processors, or, you know, not jumping in right first thing. That really creates a much more rich environment for us to be doing our best thinking together.
I couldn't agree more. I think that that self-reflection is probably one of the most powerful pieces that we often just don't take time to do. And that's where a lot of real deep learning occurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Usually at this point in the interview, I always ask my guests a common question. So I'll ask you this question, and Lee, maybe we'll start with you. What is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
It's something I touched on just lightly, but I'll reiterate that you don't need to overthink this at all, this way to silence. Some part of you knows your way to silence. So it's just innate to being human. It's important. You deserve it. It's worth it. So just keeping it simple like that.
Yeah, great. Justin?
You know, I go back to the namesake of this book, which comes from a quote that first appears in English in the 19th century from a Scottish polymath, writer, mathematician, philosopher, Thomas Carlyle. Speech is silver, silence is golden. And he describes that as meaning that speech is of time, silence is of eternity. And this little aphorism, silence is golden, some say goes back to King Solomon. And the way I understand this in my life is that, you know, words, speech, you know, the sound and stimulus of the world have a vital place. Like, we don't denigrate the importance of speech and sound and data and action. But in the silence that we can encounter that's always available, there's something timeless, there's something eternal. There's something golden, this source of energy and renewal. So we want to encourage people to tap into this more.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, both of you. I have a true confession. When reading your book, I think I figured that out, because as I'm reading it, I'm like, okay, this is an area that I haven't spent a lot of time on. So I was overthinking it. And I got to remember this, and I got to remember that, and I got, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it was just kind of like, just let it go. Trust the process. You know, take what you can, and you can always go back and review, you know. So I do think we tend to try and make it too much of a chore or too analytical, when sometimes you just have to let it go, let it feel. So
yeah, one of the best compliments we get is that this doesn't feel like another to do, another thing to put on the checklist. That yeah. it's somehow, I don't know, gives more permission to do less here and there. And I just thank you so much, Steve, for your close read of the book. It really shows and really made this conversation rich for us.
Well, yeah, it's really, really wonderful to get to connect and have this call.
Well, this has been fascinating for me, and I hope our listeners enjoyed as much as I have. I think you're doing amazing work. I think it's so important in our busy and information overload lives. So keep doing what you're doing and keep giving the message. And I really, really do appreciate your time today. I know you're both busy people, and right before the holidays as well. So take care. Thanks for being on the program. And I look forward to hearing more about what you accomplish in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Take good care.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.